Father comes to us this afternoon, it's, I think it's fair to say when you talk about mission studies in terms of UK and other parts of the world, Emma is recognized in that field. So she used to be the director. There's a center in Cambridge, Cambridge Center for World Christianity. She used to lead that, and then she's now in Edinburgh as a senior lecturer in African Christianity and African indigenous religions. Now, Emma has lived in Africa before, so she's not new to Africa. So she's lived in DRC, Congo, and in Uganda, and she's done a lot of stuff there. And so it's my privilege to invite Emma as she shares about African Christianity, which happens to be a passion of hers and one of the areas she studies as a missiologist. So it's with privilege that I invite Emma to share with us about African Christianity. A round of applause.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real privilege to be here today, and I'd just like to thank Israel for inviting me to come, for the speakers that I've heard so far, for the people who've made that delicious meal that we've just eaten, and for all the conversation that we've had. What I want to do now is I'm going to speak, and I need to take my watch off and keep an eye on the time, for about 20 minutes, and we'll have questions afterwards if we have time, or we go straight into our breakout groups. But if you've got a burning question or a comment, just interrupt, because I think we can deal with that as well. I'm conscious that you're all sitting. Does anyone need to kind of stand up and kind of wriggle around for a second, or you're going to do it in your seats? Anyone want to kind of dance or something, do that just to keep yourself awake. Israel gave me this incredibly capacious title, A Western Perspective on African Christianity. And I thought, gosh, half an hour? You know, I spend whole semesters lecturing on this kind of stuff, at least just the African Christianity bit. If I could have my next slide, I don't know how to wave at you to... So I thought I would break it down a little bit. I am going to say something about African Christianity, because of course the question is, what are we talking about when we say African Christianity? Which expression of African Christianity are we talking about? I'm going to say, whose Western perspective? I mean, in some ways it's partly mine. As Israel was saying, I've been blessed to work and to live in DR Congo, most particularly a country really close to my heart, and also to Uganda. Very formative experiences for me. But I'm also going to look at other Western perspectives and end with a case study of one particular one. And of course, when I'm answering this big title that Israel gave me, I'm looking at the other title of the conference, Exploring Diaspora Mission. That's the reason we're here today, and that's going to influence what I'm saying to you. And so with that in mind, I'm potentially going to extend my brief, but look at cultural issues at the intersection of these relationships between African Christianity and Western perspectives. And I'm going to do that by talking about cultural gaps and ecumenical inspirations. If I can have the next slide. So there's a great variety within African Christianity. And Anderson has very clearly picked out some of those points for us. He also talked about the word explosion, and that was precisely the word that I had when trying to sum up what we might talk about when we think about the African continent and we think about Christianity on that continent. There is has been an explosion of Christianity in a relatively short space of time. I should have warned you that I'm a historian, really. And so I quite like to kind of look at these big time scales. And in Africa, we have a relatively short time scale in which we've seen this explosion. And if I can see my next slide. I should have put them in a slightly different order, I think. Oh, there's a slide missing. Isn't that annoying? can you go back to the other one then? Thank you. Because since 1970, and this is where I'm having to remember my statistics, since 1970 there has been a huge growth in Christianity on the African continent. But some scholars of African Christianity are talking about Christianity in Africa as being a post-colonial religion. That the way in which it has influenced public life, the development of a whole range of different churches and different ministries has happened since independence. And for those of you unfamiliar with this, when we say since independence, we're talking about since the 1960s. Obviously, independence happened before and after that decade for different countries in Africa, but we're sort of talking about that time. And this has really puzzled scholars, because scholars in the Western world thought that Christianity would die out. It was this kind of missionary centric thing that had been imposed in the colonial era, and it would completely vanish. And quite the reverse has happened. So whilst Christianity seems to be in quite sharp decline in Europe, in Africa, something very, very different has happened. But with this explosion, with this way in which Christians on the African continent are engaging in their faith on a daily basis and expecting it to change society, to change public life, and yes, to change politics, and with all the questions that come with that, we also see a huge variety in Christian practice and in Christian belief. So even if we just talk, I threw up three slides here. I could have kind of almost picked any images. You know, we have on the far slide a picture of men in robes from a Catholic convention, bishops. We have a hierarchy. In the middle, we have the Amanazareta, so it happens from South Africa, with fusing, at least in the way that they dress, a kind of African Zulu sense with a kind of more traditional surplices and so forth. And then we have a church in Nigeria, and you can see a very strong female presence, and very obviously, I mean, I've chosen it for this kind of ecstatic, exuberant, spontaneous praise. So three images that tell different stories. Are we talking, when we say about African Christianity, about the Orthodox churches of Egypt, the Coptic Church of Ethiopia, with long traditions of remaining faithful despite feeling, if you like, cut off from other Christian communities, and taking that tradition in a very particular way, which has often been criticised by people who don't know enough about the tradition sometimes. Those Christian churches are also in the UK. Roman Catholic churches, where they have grown in the UK, have grown through this inward migration, largely not from Europe, from Poland and so forth, but also from Africa. And I know Catholic priests who say, how do I hold together in my congregation the white working class, many of whom Irish heritage, who felt marginalised in British society, with the very lively Shona congregation and the Poles, who all have their own sets of marginality within the dominant mainstream discourse, and find in Catholicism and in their day, in their weekly practice, a great succour and support, and yet their expressions of that Catholicism are very different. It's not just a language difference. How as a priest, he said. Do I deal with that? And of course, on the African continent, we have mainstream Protestant denominations, usually with a missionary heritage. We have African independent churches like the Ama Nazareta. And again, we have this burgeoning Pentecostal movement. And if any of you ever read books by anthropologists and sociologists and modern historians about Africa, you might be forgiven for thinking that there were only Pentecostal churches in Africa. Such has been the interest on this rise and trying to understand how this phenomena works, and also how it's influencing all the other churches, and how it's also a global phenomenon that we as Christians learn from each other across the globe, despite or sometimes because of our differences, and how theologies crisscross the globe. So all this comes into the mix of African Christianity. But to go to my next slide, what about the Western perspectives? Now, I think there are a number, and I'm not going to be able to show them all to you today. But this is one of them. Philip Jenkins, The Next Christendom. If anybody has read anything on what we call world Christianity, they'll have read this book or at least heard of it. Even people who've really not very interested put it in their bibliography just to show that they kind of know something. So Philip Jenkins is a clever popularizer of research. He's very good at it. He reaches wide audiences, and he made suddenly the kind of idea, ooh, there's Christianity outside the West, make some Westerners sit up and think, gosh, ooh, I hadn't really kind of noticed that before. And so he kind of distills a lot of research that was happening long before he turned to it, but he does it very well. But he says some things. Listen to these quotes. As Southern churches grow and mature, they will increasingly define their own interests in ways that have little to do with the preferences and parties of Americans and Europeans. We can even imagine Southern Christians taking the initiative to the extent of evangelizing the North. He seemed to be unaware that even in 2002, people had been doing that for some time. But, well, you know, well... Never mind, he obviously didn't read carefully his sources. In the process of changing many familiar aspects of belief and practice and exporting cultural traits presently found only in Africa and Latin America. So here he is, a kind of suggesting this kind of cultural onslaught. I don't like his language or his implications. As Christianity, he says elsewhere in the book, becomes ever more distinctively associated with Africa and the African diaspora, the religion as a whole may come to be dismissed as only what we might expect from the heart of darkness. I'm sorry if you find this uncomfortable. As Christianity comes to be seen as, in effect, jungle religion, the North would define itself against Christianity. Now, Jenkins is not saying these are his words. They might be, but he's saying this is what some people will think. And even though it might be unpalatable, you asked me to speak on Western perspectives, and I'm giving you one. And I think from what we've heard already today, that we know that this is plausible. We know that we've seen it happen in different places, and it's deeply uncomfortable. I find it particularly uncomfortable. And so we're talking about mission, but here's Jenkins suggesting that precisely because there are different cultural influences coming into the Western world is going to retreat further. It's going to be less accepting of Christianity. That's unpalatable to me, but I think it's worth thinking about and considering. And I have seen this kind of unease when I've talked with people, And usually I've talked with white Christians, Western Christians, who consider themselves to be sympathetic, but have certain notions about certain parts of African Christianity that they want to dissociate themselves from. So there's quite a lot of work that we may have to do to find places where we can talk this through. Because when I've heard it said, these are not people who I consider to be naturally bigoted, and they usually start with this great big preamble of apologetic, but then it comes out, it's the prosperity teaching, or it's issues about human sexuality that are deeply divisive in our own society, and we have different ways of dealing with them. It is the biggest cultural experiment that Europe has seen for some time, I think, what's happening. Whether rightly or wrongly, I think we are seeing something different. And so people are grappling with these issues themselves, grappling often with the fact that they are rich in a world that is largely poor, and yet they don't... they find prosperity teaching or some aspects of prosperity teaching really tricky. Because if one thing has happened in Europe, it has been a theology of suffering. So for thoughtful Western Christians, they have dealt with First World War, Second World War, Holocaust, colonialism, and the shame of colonialism as we realise what it has done to many other nations. And so we have a theology of suffering, a theology of confession, a theology of recognising, you know, it's about God dying on the cross. You know, this is Moltmann, if any of you are into that kind of thing. And that's sometimes quite difficult to hold in tension with an expectation that God blesses abundantly. So it's a kind of interesting set of questions, and I'm certainly not going to go into it in any depth, but this is something about a cultural gulf. I just want to turn that on the head very quickly with the next slide, again, extending my briefs. Here's African perspectives on Western Christianity, because it, you know, kind of goes both ways. Have any of you seen the Mr. Bean? Yeah, it's very old now, almost everybody's seen it. If you haven't, it's on YouTube. But, you know, often the comments I get, when I visit churches that are almost entirely made up of first generation Africans and their children, you know, they'll say, oh, welcome, welcome, you're going to enjoy yourself so much better here because you've obviously come from a really boring church. And I'm kind of like, yeah, I will have a good time, you know, I'm sure. So they don't actually ask me which church I've belong to. They just assume that it's going to be boring. So, you know, we have short and time focused services, which, you know, many churches are. They're very routine. They're very liturgical. Western Christians are over assimilated to the dominant culture. The services are boring and outdated. And the truth of the fact is that boring and outdated, the whole purpose of the Mr. Bean video, is that that's a view shared by most Europeans. And yet the exuberant, lively churches that I have worshipped in, as I say, with most people being first generation African migrants, are not attracting Europeans as well. So it's not just about the worship. And in fact, sadly, in my opinion, many of my British friends and relatives would just find exuberant dance very awkward in anything that's sacred, because that's what we do secular. That's the secular, sadly. There's a kind of conversation to be had around there. But I want to go back to another Western perspective. I said cultural gulf. This is ecumenical inspiration, and I have deliberately kind of tried to give you opposite poles. Here's another quotation from a book that was published by the WCC, which was looking at issues of migrants. And the author says, who's a European, white European, says, we need to see their, and he's talking about migrant churches in general, but their vitality as outposts of future Christianity and as a remarkable gift of God to a secularized world, which is desperately longing for a new sense of life and hope. They could contribute to the renewing of the whole church, bringing reconciliation in the midst of all forms of brokenness in our countries and societies. The deep spiritual sickness afflicting the rich North might actually be healed when voices from the non-Western world are properly heard and understood. Now, this is a Western perspective that is closer to my own. It's hopeful, it's expectant, it recognises that the global North, Europe, the West, whatever you want to call it, has not got all the answers, that it has deep problems in its society, and it needs to understand and hear voices from other parts of the world in order to see this. But again, which voices, just in African Christianity, do we need to hear? Where's the, we need a kind of process of discernment. I've said how people may kind of react, but which voices are the ones we need to hear? Where is God leading us? And that, for me, is the key question. I want to show you my next slide again. I've subtitled it African Perspectives on Western Christianity, but this is really more of a kind of a common project. This was an extended listening project that I did. It was in a church I was very much involved with, so this is a kind of insiderly perspective in many ways, where we were trying to move from, and this is where I want to borrow Usher's very evocative term, move from being multicoloured to being multicultural. So thank you for that, Usher. Trying to find out who, we were developing a multicoloured, if you like, congregation. Who was there? Why were they there? What did they like? What didn't they like so much? What might improve our togetherness? So in some ways it was a kind of project of implied theology, and just listening, interviewing, and then reporting back to the church council and trying to embed some of the suggestions. And so one of the people I spoke to said about this particular congregation, it's a place where we worship people from all different cultures and different denominations. We get together like we are one, and we feel the same. You feel that this is an umbrella bringing you all together. I don't like spiritual ghettoism. Now, I can talk about that project at length because I think there were some very... It took place in a particular place at a particular time, and there were particular reasons for it. But the focus of how we can live well together was very key. And how we can listen to each other and learn from each other, and how we can do that structurally. And I think this is very much what Anderson was talking about, how we might apply. We look at our context, we see it's different, but there are also some bigger questions that we can ask. There are some bigger issues that we can pinpoint. I want to give you one example of another listening project. And this is one, now I've moved up to Edinburgh, Church of Scotland's perspectives on African Christianity. And I thought this was particularly interesting. This is a report from the World Mission Council on Lessons for Scotland from Christian Faith to Africa to the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. So it's central body. I'd like to tell you that if it was presented to the central body, everybody immediately puts it into action in all the congregations around Scotland, but I would be lying. However, here is the World Mission Council and various people having done some reflection with some African church leaders with whom they have been in partnership for, you know, a couple of hundred years, not the individuals, obviously, just the churches. So this is, you know, connections with, if you like, a particular missionary heritage. And they talk about an attentive accompaniment is key to the beginning to interpret what might be transferable from the African to the Scottish context. Faith is something that is incarnate in situations and contexts. So this means that reality is not just out there, rather reality is mediated by meaning in the context of culture and historical settings and interpreted through particular thought forms. And knowledge, therefore, is co-created by listening to and working with partner churches and organisations. So this is a long conversation that they're saying. This is not an easy fix, not an easy kind of, well, Africa does it this way, or even the Presbyterian churches that we know in Africa, that's their focus, do it this way. This is what we can just pull from it. But it is saying we have brothers and sisters in Africa who understand and live their Christian faith in particular ways that's vibrant and alive, and we, as part of the statistic that Anderson showed us earlier, are declining. And we need to address that. We need to understand something from a different part of the world that we've had a long conversation with, and to recognise that for all we've talked about marginality and problems of power in the UK, in some ways the power is shifting, the influence is shifting. And so I think this is quite an interesting report that at least some parts of the Church of Scotland are beginning to recognise that. And so if I have my final slide. Church of Scotland, they're not the same, by the way. Church of England, as you know, is Episcopal. Church of Scotland is Presbyterian, entirely different ecclesial structures and quite significantly different ways of working and operating. But nevertheless, kind of national churches with that whole legacy that. And it itemises these different things that they see that they can learn from the African churches. And it's actually quite vague. If you read the report, you know, it's really it's difficult pinpointing that thing that's going to say, yes, this is going to kind of revolutionise the Church of Scotland. But they take it one by one. And I think for me is what's on the other side really came through as I read their itemised points. So the appreciation of the spiritual in everyday life. That coming through at every point and being reminded of that, and that being part of the rhythm of people's day, is something that the Church of Scotland was saying, I think we've lost. Wholehearted worship. Now, it may take some time before the vast majority of members of the Church of Scotland are kind of leaping up and down in exuberance, you know? But waving your hands in the air is only one form of showing that you're worshipping wholeheartedly. I don't mind doing it. Other people, you know, it's not their thing. But wholehearted, doing it with your whole heart, being fully engaged in it. And then this other thing that I think was actually most striking is saying to the Church of Scotland, there are places where Christianity is growing, where growth is normative. When we've got used to decline, we're working with that. We're working on a maintenance model. We're working on a decline model. We're working on this kind of remnant model. Now, there's a lot of in the Bible about remnant, and it may be that Christendom, ex-Christendom, has to go through remnant. I'm not a prophet and I'm a historian, but, you know, let's just kind of hold that as a possibility about what we do as remnant. But nevertheless, it does drain resources and drain energy. And a lot of people in mainstream churches in the UK are tired. They are tired and they are sad because they are not seeing their faith transmitted to earlier generations. They don't understand the new society that Britain is creating. They try and understand it. Sometimes they're retreating into a kind of moral and intellectual ghetto. And they are increasingly elderly, so they don't have the energy. They want to see this and they want to see that in their churches. They don't see it. And they're still very wedded to the beautiful buildings that people built for them some time ago. And certainly in Scotland, most of them were never full anyway. But that's another story. But, you know, this is somewhere that they go. They go for sanctuary. They enjoy the majesty of the building. It lifts them. And yet they also have this burden of keeping it. And, of course, as soon as you say to the local community, oh, well, maybe we'll bulldoze it after all. You know, there's mass petitions from people who like to walk past it every day. This, for me, this growth is normative, is a key thing to say and to keep saying that there are places in the world where that happens. And I thought this other thing was very important, and so I've quoted it in full. We see the move of African brothers and sisters to Scotland as part of a greater move of God and would encourage congregations to engage and learn from the African diaspora. Now, again, it's not going to happen overnight, but here you can quote it. This is a church who is seeking that, is not necessarily quite sure what's going to happen next, is perhaps kind of still working it out. But that's an invitation that we learn from each other, and that the diaspora churches, I mean, this is particularly in Scotland, but elsewhere in the UK as well, have a role to play in the Christian landscape and in what we believe that the Holy Spirit is doing.